This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. As we're hearing in the news, the state's Supreme Court ruled earlier this afternoon that the state's Republican-drawn legislative maps are unconstitutional. Republicans have held big majorities in the state legislature for more than a decade, thanks in part to favorable district lines. The 4-3 decision by the court today means the state will likely have to draw new maps. Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson is with us for an update. Sean, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Rob.
Tell us, what was the majority's argument here? They painted this as common sense arguments about contiguous districts.
Yeah, that is what it boiled down to. I mean, for all that we've talked about with these legislative maps for more than a decade now and a variety of court challenges, what the court's liberal majority ended up saying here is that these maps are unconstitutional because the districts aren't contiguous. The word contiguous has been interpreted by courts over the last, 50 or so years to mean different things. But the court's majority, in an opinion written by Jill Krofsky, said it means what it says, that it's common sense that contiguous means you have to have adjoining territory. And in about 50 assembly districts and 20 Senate districts, you don't have that. So the maps are unconstitutional and we're going to have new ones.
The conservative minority, each of the justices, I believe, wrote their own opinion. Sean, I gave a quick breeze through some strong language there saying, hey, this is outcome-based judging. What did we see there?
Yeah, I mean, the if you look at this opinion, which is very lengthy, it is mostly dissents in this case. You had Justices Annette Ziegler, Rebecca Bradley, and Brian Hagedorn each writing their own. They talk about this opinion in their words. They frame it as the first opinion by an openly progressive faction where the members of the majority, quote, shed their robes, usurped the prerogatives of the legislature, and delivered the spoils to their preferred political party. These handmaidens of the Democratic Party, this is from Justice Rebecca Bradley, quote, trample the rule of law. So very strong wording there. You wouldn't expect anything less than a dissent. But the majority opinion, much shorter, says, look, this is the way it is. The Constitution says they need to be contiguous. These are not contiguous. And we're going to have to draw new maps.
So who's we? Who draws these maps?
It depends. The court says... the court leaves it open for the legislature to draw new maps, and that, of course, would require the governor to sign them. We have a Republican legislature. They like these maps, and Democratic Governor Tony Evers does not, and the idea of them getting together on a set of compromise maps seems pretty unlikely. And so the court does say that, assuming that the maps can't pass the legislature and be signed the governor, they will begin the process of redistricting. The legislature, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss specifically, said today in a statement that the U.S. Supreme Court will have the final say in this case. Now, precisely what that means, we don't know, but that is where, he is turning his attention to now. He wants to fight this, it sounds like, through some sort of appeal at the federal level through the U.S. Supreme Court.
And Sean, we have an election coming up next year. When do these maps have to be in place?
Plaintiffs were initially arguing they needed to be in place by the spring, basically, so that candidates could start circulating petitions to run in these new districts. So if you're looking at March or April as a deadline for this, that's not a whole lot of time for something to get done here, but it's a few months. I expect you're going to have a busy few months of redistricting news between here and the court, the legislature, the governor's office, and potentially, we'll see what happens, an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court.
And I'm sure we'll be back in touch with you, Sean, all through this process. Thanks for getting us up to speed.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. He talked with us about today's state Supreme Court ruling that found Wisconsin's current legislative election maps to be unconstitutional. Now, the Colorado State Supreme Court ruled this week that former President Donald Trump is disqualified from the presidential ballot in that state. The court found that Trump violated the 14th Amendment's insurrection clause for his involvement with the attack at the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. The ruling's on hold as attorneys for Trump now are appealing the case to the U.S. Supreme Court, which is likely to make a final decision that will have impacts across the country. A similar lawsuit has been filed in state courts in Wisconsin and several other states, while the Minnesota Supreme Court already rejected a 14th Amendment case against Trump, at least for the presidential primary. We're learning more about the legal arguments surrounding this. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this Colorado Supreme Court ruling? Do you agree with the outcome? Why or why not? What questions do you have about the many moving parts in these court cases? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. David Schultz is a professor of political science at Hamline University and a professor of law at the University of Minnesota. He's the author of several books on politics and law, including Trumpism, American Politics in the Age of Politainment. David, welcome back to Central Time.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, and happy holidays to everybody.
All right. We've talked about this before, David, in your home state of Minnesota. How big a deal is this Colorado ruling saying, nope, the former president can't be on the ballot in the presidential primary or the runoff as they rule it?
Both legally and politically, it's a big deal here. From a legal point of view, it's an interpretation that if accepted by, let's say, the U.S. Supreme Court or by other state courts, it could lead to Trump being kicked off the ballot all across the country. So that's the first issue. And that's why, because it's an interpretation also of the Constitution, that is the 14th Amendment, it's likely to go to the U.S. Supreme Court. But politically, this has many prongs to it. You know, one of them, as I just mentioned, potentially it means he's not just off the ballot in Colorado, but with lawsuits pending, as you pointed out there, in Wisconsin and many, many other states, Trump potentially could be thrown off the ballot in lots of states. And before the voters even get to cast a single vote, the election could almost be decided. And then yet another political dimension is how this plays out with Trump's narrative, which he's been arguing, of saying that 4 years ago, it was a stolen election. They're trying to steal it again now. How does this deal with political mobilization of his base? It goes in lots of different directions. But this is important because prior to the Colorado Supreme Court decision, 0-7. What I mean by that, there were seven lawsuits that had been decided and saying that Trump, for a variety of reasons, is not going to be taken off the ballot because of the insurrection clause. This was the first court to say, yes, in fact, he can be taken off the ballot or prevented from going on the ballot.
Remind us of the basic case here that some, including some conservative legal scholars, have made that the 14th Amendment, this one clause, applies to former President Trump.
Sure. Okay. So what we have is a clause that was adopted in the 14th Amendment, Section 3, after the Civil War. And paraphrasing it roughly, it says that individuals who had previously held office in the United States and had taken an oath to uphold the Constitution could be basically prevented from holding office in the future unless Congress, by a two-thirds vote, allows them to do so. It's called the Insurrection Clause. Most legal historians say that this clause was written to address problems right after the Civil War, when former members of Congress who fled, became part of the Confederacy, wanted to run again for Congress. And so it was, some people say, address that. But some conservative legal scholars have argued that the clause is still alive and still can be used if, in fact, you accept the fact that the clause still applies today, that the presidency is an office as specified under the Insurrection Clause, that the clause can be what's called self-executing or self-enforcing, and what Trump did on January 6, 2021, constituted insurrection. And that's essentially what the Colorado Supreme Court reached the conclusion is on all those points.
Now, it's interesting. I've read a couple of pieces by liberal legal scholars who in these pieces say, I don't want the former president to become president again. They say it would be bad for the country, but that should be done by voters, that this is a misapplication of the law that sets a bad precedent. This is definitely not a slam dunk argument, regardless, in some cases, of political perspective.
You're absolutely correct at this point. You've got some conservatives, some liberals saying this is the way, if you don't like Trump, to address what Trump did. But a lot of people are arguing that in a democracy, at the end of the day, the people get the choice. They get to make their own decisions. And many people argue that almost a quarter century ago, when the U.S. Supreme Court rendered Bush v. Gore and decided the case about electoral votes and vote counting in Florida and effectively decided the election, many people have said we should, at the end of the day, let the people decide who gets elected, not let the courts who get decided. And that's a broader question about democracy, on top of which the outline that I gave you in terms of was it an insurrection? Does it still apply? The clause still apply? Is it self-executing? These are all incredibly contestable legal points that will become the basis for appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court.
We're talking to political science and law professor David Schultz about the Colorado State Supreme Court ruling that Donald Trump is ineligible for the presidential ballot in that state, what this means for the election as a whole, what could be coming to the U.S. Supreme Court. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University of Law at the University of Minnesota, looking at the Colorado Supreme Court decision that would make former President Trump ineligible for the presidential ballot in that state based on a clause in the 14th Amendment. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Fairchild. Chris, hi.
Hi. Well, first off, I had a comment here. I just wanted to say I work from a default position that the 14th Section 3 would be self-executing. It is the Constitution which precludes Mr. Trump, not the courts, whereas they did some of the light work. But I guess my question to the guest would be, I tend to draw a straight line from the United States and perhaps the failure to prosecute Jefferson Davis after the Civil War to this moment. And I was wondering what your introspect on that would be. If had we answered this question, say, 140 years ago, would we not be in this position today?
Interesting question, Chris. David, what do you think?
That is a great historical question here, which we could probably do an entire show on. But yes, the quite possibly the decision at the end of the day not to proceed with a trial of treason against Jefferson Davis. And for people who don't remember, Jefferson Davis was the head of the Confederacy, the president of the Confederacy, and the U.S. government abandoned its case against him. Had they proceeded and reached a judgment on the merits, a real verdict, we might be in a very different position historically today than we were back then. But because we didn't, we have a lot of questions open. And again, I'm not taking a position one way or the other, on this matter here. The Colorado Supreme Court decision is hefty. It's between the dissent and the majority opinion. It's well over 200 pages. And all the questions, like the reader referred to here, about does the insurrection clause apply and stuff like that, these become the basis of appeal when the case likely gets to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Thanks a lot for that call, Chris. We'll go to Steve now in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I think at this point now, it's fair to say the Democrats, the liberals, the progressives, all those people within the swamp that match that, it's fair to say they have lost the moral high ground when it comes to threats to democracy. We see it here. We've seen it just recently with the maps when unethical Janet made a decision to throw out the Wisconsin maps while the Democrats refuse to have a compromise solution because they know the Supreme Court will give them the maps they want. And the fact in the last election, the Democrats worked their tails off to keep the Green Party off the ballot to benefit the Democrats.
Steve, I gotcha. I want to focus in on Steve's thoughts, David, about this this particular case. He's saying, hey, this is a transparent effort by Democrats to keep former President Trump off the ballot. A lot of the cases, interestingly, filed by a long shot Republican presidential candidate, not one on the debate stage. But that perception definitely out there. Steve's not alone in that thinking.
Well, I was going to say, first off, the article that is sort of the genesis of this entire claim was written by two conservative legal scholars, one of who served in the first George Bush administration. And we have both, again, as you pointed out, liberals and conservatives or Democrats, Republicans, however you want to categorize it, who are both on the side of saying use the clause and not use it. And as you pointed out, in many cases, the groups that are bringing the lawsuits have connections to Republicans. And so it's factually, I don't think it's accurate what the caller said, but from a perception point of view, I think this is what's happening. And I think for Trump supporters, these lawsuits fit into the narrative that he used 3 years ago or 4 years ago about a stolen election. I think now he gets to use that stolen election mantra as a result of the Colorado opinion.
Thanks for the call, Steve. Dennis joins us now in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. I realize with courts, they need to follow along with somebody is innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. But the thing is, there is also moral guilt. And from what's been going on, Trump is definitely morally guilty. And if Trump gets another chance at an election, it's just going to be the whole rigmarole all over again.
Dennis, thanks a lot for the call. I want to start with that innocent until proven guilty thing, David. And that's central to this argument about, is this clause self-executing, meaning it's automatically played? Just like if I had tried to run for president when I was 30 years old, well, the Constitution says nope. Somebody might have to file a court case to keep, if I try to run, they might have to do that. But it's automatic. That's part of the argument here with the insurrection clause. But 30 years old is one easy thing to measure. Insurrection right. is another thing to measure.
No, you're absolutely correct. And this is where it becomes more complicated now, because one of the issues here is, what does it mean to have an insurrection? What is, was an insurrection defined as? And but the lower courts in Colorado reached the conclusion that he engaged in insurrection. But this becomes an important question here, because remember, especially in the federal case against Donald Trump being brought in District of Columbia, involving events out of January 6th. Some of those questions, although he's not being put on trial for insurrection there, we have no proof of guilt that Donald Trump has done anything wrong yet. And this becomes an issue in the Colorado case where, and under the 14th Amendment, how do you go about determining if somebody is, quote, liable or guilty or whatever phrase, culpable for insurrection? It really wasn't a criminal trial. Trump's not been convicted of anything. And I think this becomes one of the questions, again, that the Supreme Court will have to grapple with. And I think one of the arguments that the dissenters in the Colorado case said is that Donald Trump didn't get appropriate due process in terms of this determination. Now, the question about whether or not somebody is morally culpable for doing things, I leave that to the listeners in terms of rendering their own judgment.
Time for one more caller. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hi.
Much. I'm a legalist, Civil War legal historian. And what everyone seems to be missing is that there is an act. It's the Act of 1795 that specifically defines insurrection. I believe it pertained to the Whiskey Rebellion, thanks to George Washington, and is defined as: the specific criteria for insurrection is when local law enforcement is overwhelmed. They specifically mention U.S. Marshals and the justice system. It seems to me that on January 6th, the local law enforcement was clearly overwhelmed. And to answer the after Civil War and Jefferson Davis, the War Department did specifically charge Jefferson Davis with planning the Lincoln assassination, but that was never followed through for a variety of reasons.
And okay, thanks a lot. We don't have a lot of time left, but thanks for bringing that up. David, the 1795 guidance points toward this as an insurrection?
Possibly it does. But even if that provides the guidance, the questions still go back to the issue of whether or not the 14th Amendment applies to Trump, and that the facts that occurred, whatever the facts were on January 6th, actually rise to the level of a violation of that act, and whether that act, in fact, is the basis for determining insurrection under the 14th Amendment. Lots of still thorny legal questions. And as I sort of wrap up here, these will be the issues that the U.S. Supreme Court will likely have to take up when it gets the case early next year.
David, I won't ask you to predict what the U.S. Supreme Court is going to do here. You mentioned early next year. How soon do you expect we'll have some sort of indication? Because, you know, all this while, people are getting on ballots.
I think you're right. I think it's going to happen sooner as opposed to later in January. If I'm going to give a prediction here, they'll find some way to overturn the Colorado Supreme Court decision without ruling on the merits, which means they're not going to address the question and say he did or he did not engage in insurrection. I think they're likely to say something along the lines of that the clause is not self-executing and therefore void the decision. But I can be surprised.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota, with us today to talk about the Colorado State Supreme Court taking Donald Trump off the ballot in that state based on a 14th Amendment clause and what that decision means for the election. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, people are moving away from some online platforms, Facebook and others, in favor of group chats and group texting as their way of doing social online stuff. We'll find out what's driving that trend. You can use an old-fashioned medium to tell us if you're doing that, too. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Are you doing more stuff in chats and text than on social media? And Wisconsin author Patrick Rothfuss has a new book out set in his popular fantasy world. We'll listen back to a conversation where we preview the book, look at fantasy fiction and more, and great books to read to kids, too. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll learn about President Biden's recent executive order aimed at improving tribal access to federal funds. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Earlier this month, President Biden signed an executive order to make it easier for tribal nations to access federal funding. According to a White House statement, the executive order is an attempt to remedy historical attacks on tribal sovereignty and support tribal nations' right to self-governance.
That's why today I'm signing an executive order to reform the federal funding system for tribes, cutting out red tape so you can deliver for your community faster and better.
Levi Rickard is the founder, publisher, and editor of Native News Online. He was in the nation's capital earlier this month for the two-day Tribal Nations Summit, where the new executive order was released. Levi, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, happy to be back, Tyler.
Can you talk about why accessing federal funds has been difficult for many tribes across the country?
Well, often when tribes have tried to access federal funds, it's been real cumbersome, very difficult. Sometimes they don't know where to go. And the executive order, kind of under the heading of self-determination for tribes, was really set forth a pathway to make it easier for tribes to access funds. I will tell you this, that this administration has been one of the most favorable administrations towards tribal nations, Indian country, as we call it, in my lifetime. And quite frankly, it's difficult sometimes because in the past, because tribes quite didn't know where to go. And this is going to provide like a clearinghouse. And it's really, as I said, setting the pathway. It's signed 2 weeks ago on Wednesday. So it's way too early to say how it's working because I'm not sure it's working.
It's brand new.
But it's, yeah, it's brand new.
And a report that came out, I think linked to the Tribal Summit, suggested that, you know, okay, with the current system of bureaucracy, a tribe with more resources might be able to navigate it, but smaller tribes or ones with the less money to work with, maybe without as big a legal department, it potentially shut them out of receiving money that they might otherwise have had access to. Is that something you've seen?
That's very true, and it was really particularly true during the COVID-19 pandemic when it wasn't just for Indians, Indian country per se, but others. You know, there was a lot of money that was given out by the federal government to get through the pandemic. Tribes in some cases had to turn money back in. They just didn't have the capabilities, and even at you mentioned legal, but even at grant writing levels, they don't always have that. And I think as we move forward, I think it's this administration is looking real hard at how to work with tribes so that they can have the technical assistance that's needed. And the president called it red tape. I tend to call it white tape. It's kind of as a joke, but that was probably the biggest misgiving of his speech. I think when he said that, I wanted to yell out, "Hey, what's white tape?" It seems to always be that adhesive that stops us from moving forward. The old notorious red tape.
I want to talk a little more about, you mentioned that tribal access to capital clearinghouse. As you said, it's brand new. We don't know what it's doing so far, but what is the concept here? Tell us a little bit more about what it's supposed to do and how you hope it could work.
Well, within government itself, tribes, my understanding, and I may be off two or three, but there's like 17 agencies, federal departments, agencies that Native Americans tribes really work with. And sometimes there would be programs being administered or offered by various programs, very similar, and it's very, very confusing to tribes. And I think the clearinghouse, we understand, is really going to simplify it so that tribes, when they can get into a database, can really figure out where they need to go for what funds and how they can be spent. Are they loans? Are they grants? Those types of things. And anyone who's ever applied for a federal grant knows it's very, very difficult process, very cumbersome.
Talking to Levi Rickert, founder, publisher, and editor of Native News Online, talking about a new executive order that affects how tribal governments around the country relate with the federal government, trying to make it easier to access money that they're eligible for in the first place. Levi, it may sound like a bureaucratic change to some people, but as you wrote and some others have written, this is also connected to the idea of tribal sovereignty, that tribal governments will have, I think, fewer strings attached to how they manage their own affairs. Can you talk about that side of things?
Yes, and I will say this, across the country, there are varying levels of sophistication among the tribes, and some tribes have... and there's different periods of time that the government dealt with us in different ways. And they basically terminated a lot of tribes in the 1950s. And some of the tribes have just, in a sense, gotten their federal recognition back. And with that, they're really like infant tribes, even toddler tribes. They're not sophisticated as like the Cherokee Nation that has been in existence for almost 200 years. And has had a relationship with the federal government. But those new tribes that come on board will say, I think just in the last 5 years, there's been about five or six across the country. And they really have a difficult time learning the ropes, as they say. And as president called it red tape, I call it white tape. But in terms of sovereignty and self-determination, it really is, how can I say, it's faster to get to being a sovereign if you know what you're doing and you can afford to do what you want to do as a sovereign nation. And that, I love that term, self-determination. So often as we Native Americans have lived under a paternalistic philosophy from the federal government, you will do it our way. Well, this new era will bring in the idea that tribes can hire the right people and make the right decisions through their tribal sovereign governments.
I want to quote from the piece you wrote about this, Levi. President Biden, quoting now, President Biden, Secretary Holland realized there's still much work to be done to correct the decades and arguably centuries of neglect by the federal government to fulfill their treaty trust obligations to Indian country. What do you mean by that neglect? Tell us about some of the things that, that fit into that.
Well, you know, and I'll use broadband as a very prime example. We are so far behind when it comes to broadband on many Indian reservations throughout the United States. I mean, I've heard and I've written about where parents have to literally drive to the McDonald's or they drive 30 miles so their children can do homework, and because there's lack of broadband. And I guess our treaties basically said the trust responsibility of the government should be able to provide us with some of the basic needs of life. And I think most of us would argue internet these days is a basic need of life, especially for our kids who have to compete with those kids in affluent suburbs, but who have, you know, various devices at home, laptops, tablets, etc., and they have the internet. But our kids literally have to get in their parents' pickup truck have to, you know, like I say, go to the McDonald's or they go to a tribal police department, sit outside there. And there's one case, I think it was in Arizona, where so many parents were taking them outside a police station that it basically jammed the station's ability to have their own internet and said, hey, we can't let you guys do this anymore. You're impeding our public safety. So there's a lot of things that go into it, and from a real practical sense, the reality checks of life, we are far behind in many areas. And so hopefully this executive order will help us get to where we need to be in terms of those trust responsibilities the federal government have.
And briefly, this also includes an assessment, I understand, of chronic funding shortfalls for tribes to figure out where gaps are, where additional funding is needed. What, in just our last less than a minute now, what do you hope that would focus on?
Well, I'll go right back to where I was talking about broadband. I would love to see that get fixed. I was on the phone yesterday, did an interview with somebody who works in the area of agriculture. She said our shortfall in Indian country is $49 billion. That's with a B, $49 billion for the native farmers to be able to exercise their abilities to farm and get back to some food sovereignty and kind of go back to grow products so we can eat healthy. And $49 billion is a lot of money, and that's a shortfall that's not going to be made up in 1 year or maybe even 10 years.
Levi, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Hey, my pleasure.
That's Levi Rickert, founder, publisher, and editor of Native News Online. He talked to us today about President Biden's executive order to increase tribal access to federal funding. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. In the ever-changing landscape of the book industry, one genre is standing out as the fastest growing in fiction, particularly among young adult readers. Romance novels were the highest-selling genre of fiction in 2022, with the research company Circana reporting 19 million units sold just through August of last year. That followed a strong 2021, and the genre is seeing a two-year high in overall growth. Analysts say stores are dedicating more shelf space to romance, and the social media app TikTok may be helping the genre reach new, younger audiences. We're visiting the world of romance novels to learn why readers are having a love affair with the books. Jessica Van Sloten is the Dean of Arts and Sciences at Bay College in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Her research focuses on teaching and learning, and she also is a scholar of popular romance fiction. She formerly taught at UW-Green Bay, where she gave a TEDx talk entitled Romance Novels Are Feminist. Jessica, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, Rob. It's great to be here.
How do we define the romance genre? You know, a lot of books will have a love angle to them. What is it that makes something a romance novel?
Yes, that's a great question to start us off with, because often there's a lot of confusion about how to qualify something as a romance. So there's basically two essential elements that mark something as romance. It needs to have a central love story, so that needs to be the main focus. And it needs to have what the Romance Writers of America call an emotionally satisfying and optimistic ending.
Now, romance novels are selling great, but they sometimes don't get a lot of respect, it seems like, for a couple reasons. I think some people just look down on them as, maybe formulaic or cliche on one hand. And then something I know you've talked about, including in that TEDx talk I mentioned, is that from a feminist angle, people say, well, is this really a great message? You, I think, are defending romance novels these days from both of those concerns. Make your case.
Yeah, so I think they have been historically maligned since the beginning. It was fiction that was primarily associated with women, and there was a lot of skepticism around that and around things that women like. And as the genre has kind of expanded, where I see the promise is that it's giving messages of hope and possibility to all kinds of people to be loved for who they are. We see a big rise in representation of LGBTQ folks in romance novels, in people of color in romance novels. And so that's where I see the potential and the celebration of joy rather than only oppression, right? So those are some of the ways that I personally embrace the genre, and I know some of my fellow readers do as well.
In addition to having just a more diverse array of characters and maybe authors, are there other ways in which you've seen romance novels change over the years?
Yeah, I think there's been a transformation, particularly of the biggest genre convention that people like to think about, the ending, right? That historically romance novels ended in marriage. If you think of Jane Austen's classic novels as romance, they always end with, the couple getting married, what we call the happily ever after. And over time, that really transformed into what we call a happily for now, right? There's more of a temporariness sometimes to those endings, and what that happy ending looks like is going to be different. And so I think that's something that's interesting. We also see a change in the voice, right? It was really popular for a long time to have alternate voices. So if you had a traditional heterosexual romance, you would have one chapter from the male perspective, the next from the female, back and forth. And in the last couple of years, we've seen a rise in single point of view romance novels.
Now, we've seen pretty good sales numbers, as I was saying at the beginning, and some thought at any way that that younger people, young adults, are driving some of those increases. What do you see as the appeal of the modern romance novel to younger readers?
Yeah, I think it's fascinating to think about how this rise parallels both the rise of first Bookstagram, which is sort of people my generation, Gen X, gravitated towards that social media, and younger generations transforming that into book talk, right? So on TikTok, as well as the pandemic, right? And just the influence that had on people's habits of consumption of media and the kinds of stories that they were looking for. And what romance provides with us is hope and possibility, a place where characters are loved for who they truly are, and vulnerability, as well as some interesting rise in a kind of dark romance subgenre. So I think, getting at the uncertain times that we've lived in, and romance gives us a nice container that we know things are going to end well in the end of the book, even if it's turbulent throughout. So I think those couple of threads are important. And the third one I would mention is the rise in sort of a parasocial relationship, the ways that consumers of media can be connected to the creators of media through social media, right? They can follow their favorite authors on TikTok and Instagram and feel like they're having a relationship with them, right? And so there's a closeness that's very exciting and appealing for readers.
Talking to Jessica Van Sloten with Bay College in the UP in Michigan, looking at romance novels, a big boost in popularity lately, and they've changed over the years, too. Now, that talk I mentioned you did at UW-Green Bay a couple few years ago, looking at seeing romance novels as feminist and not just, as some people have criticized, reinforcing gender norms. Can you give us a Cliff's Notes version of what were the case you were making there?
Sure. I think the case I made in that TED talk was that we really see these stories that are places of positivity and a way for people to work out their relationships to power. So a scholar I really admire, Catherine Roach, thinks that romance novels give folks who don't have as much power, traditionally women or maybe LGBTQ folks, ways of leveling the playing field through romantic relationships, right? So, you know, if you think about your typical romance storyline, there's conflict, but in the end, there's happiness and usually some kind of egalitarianism. And so that's one thread that I think makes them a potentially feminist genre.
I'm a science fiction reader. That's kind of my genre. And there's some works where I'll, you know, defend the writing and the innovation and things like that. And they're awesome. And there are some that are, you know, kind of cliche and formulaic, but I still kind of like them anyway, because it's my kind of thing. Do you see that kind of variation as well within the romance novel genre?
Yes, definitely. Right. And as I was as thinking about coming on the air today, I'm thinking there's whole subgenres that I just don't read, right? For one reason or another, they're just not something that I'm drawn to. And that as someone who has a literary background too, I'm really interested in the quality of the writing and the craft of the plot, right? And there is a lot of variation. And I think the most important thing is that people are finding stories that resonate with them. And for each reader, that's going to be a little bit different. And romance is such a big tent that there's something for everyone. And the rise of self-publishing has allowed more people to write stories and get them in front of readers. And I think that's a powerful other component of this rise in popularity.
Now, if somebody's listening and thinking, okay, yeah, I'm a reader. Maybe you've got me almost persuaded with this romance novel thing to check it out. Where you can name names if you want here, Jessica, where would you steer them to start? Like, what would be a good entry point or author or subgenre or whatever that new romance novel reader could open the door with?
Yeah, I'd like to tell you about a book I'm reading right now. Okay. I haven't finished it, but I know it's going to have a happy ending because that's the promise of the genre. But it's by an author named Adriana Herrera. And it's called A Caribbean Heiress in Paris. And it's a historical romance. So if there's any fans out there of Bridgerton, for example, this might be for you. It's set in 1899 Paris World's Exposition. And she does a lot of really clever things in updating a historical romance in that she has characters of color, characters, you know, from the Caribbean islands who have envisioned a way to produce liquor, not relying on slave labor, right? And so she's really making some interesting statements and really transforming and modernizing the genre and doing it in a historical time setting, which I think is pretty cool.
Now, a personal example for me, I grew up thinking, you know, Jane Austen, you mentioned earlier, you know, I'm a guy and that's mostly written for women. So I never touched it. I didn't consciously avoid it. And then I started reading Jane Austen. And I'm like, this is really good. And I read more and more. Can you make the case to the guys like me out there who might think romance novels, they're just not for me to begin with?
Yeah, I think one interesting way to think about it is that Jane Austen was writing what we might call domestic fiction, right? And male authors have written that over time, right? Maybe the narratives have had a different arc or they've prioritized things other than the love relationship. But, you know, even if someone is, say, a Jonathan Franzen fan, right? He writes these complex families and relationships, right? So I would say that someone could pick up a romance novel and find some interest and satisfaction. And actually, there's a great author, Lissa K. Adams, writes these bromance book club series, and it's about a group of men who read romance novels in order to have better relationships. So, and they're pro athletes who are in this club that read together. So there's a lot of interesting entry points for readers of all genders.
Jessica, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Jessica Van Sloten, Dean of Arts and Sciences and a scholar of popular romance fiction at Bay College in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. We listened back to our talk with her about the rising popularity of romance novels and how the genre has changed over time. If you are a fan of the genre, if you have favorites, let us know about it. Email ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Barrett. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.